Wonderful. Well, thank you all for being here. So just, I guess, a couple other questions. So how many of you are familiar with health impact assessment? You do have a quick show of hands. Okay, great. I think we heard a little bit about your housing background, but how many of you have done work directly with your local public housing authority in your community? Okay, great. And then I think we covered the rest of this. That's helpful just to get a sense of people's backgrounds. So, excellent. So, I don't have anything to disclose, as we were indicated to play. So, as I said, I work with the Health Impact Project. We are a collaboration of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trusts, and our goal is really to make health a routine consideration in public policy making. And we do this primarily by supporting the use of health impact assessments, or HIAs, as you'll hear me refer to them. And we do that in several ways. We fund health impact assessment work at state and local levels. We support a network of technical assistance and training providers across the country. And then we conduct health impact assessments on federal level decisions. And so the example that you'll hear Barry and I talk about today is one of those where we are doing an HIA at a federal level policy. So as you all know, and this is the theme of the conference at APHA this year, there's a growing and established, very established body of research that shows us that the primary factors that influence our health are not the medical care that we receive, but rather the social and environmental and economic factors of where we live and work and play. And you all know this very well from your work in public health. But one of the challenges with that is that usually public health professionals are not at the table when many of those other decisions are being made. So when we're deciding on transportation policy or housing policy or agriculture or food policy, public health is often not at the table in those discussions, and those decisions aren't thought about from a health lens. And so that's really what health impact assessment tries to do. It tries to bridge that gap and bring health into the discussion around decisions in those other sectors. So this definition that you can see on the screen is adapted from the National Research Council, which developed guidance for HIAs in 2011. It is essentially a systematic process that uses a range of different data sources and methods and considers input from stakeholders, and that is done in order to determine the potential health implications of a proposed policy or plan or project or program on health. And also thinks about the distribution of those effects. So are those effects distributed equally across the population, or are there some groups who may be disproportionately burdened or are disproportionately benefited by those outcomes? And then finally, it provides recommendations on monitoring and managing those effects. So health impact assessment thinks about proactively making recommendations before a decision is made so that we can make better policies moving forward. So just a couple of the key points to be aware of for HIA. Again, it's conducted to inform a specific decision. So you're forward-looking. You're using it to inform a discussion and a decision that's actively under consideration. So it's looking prospectively. We have a broad analytic framework. So we take a very broad approach to health. We think about the social and economic and environmental conditions in the way that we define health. Collaboration with stakeholders is a critical part of HIA, and I think one of the areas where the process is really just, it can be really amazing for developing relationships across a range of stakeholders. And so you bring together potentially affected communities that might be impacted by the decision, decision makers themselves, other stakeholders in the community, and it can set the stage for dialogue among groups that maybe have not had, have not seen eye to eye on a particular policy discussion before, all around a frame of health. It's pragmatic, so we try to use the best available evidence that's available to be timely with the findings to really inform a decision and to provide decision makers with the information that they need, and then focus on solutions, so making sure that you're making feasible recommendations that can be implemented. So this graphic just shows you a bit about the different topics that health impact assessments have addressed. There's been about over 300 health impact assessments completed or in progress in the United States. And as you can see from the graphic, a substantial amount of those have been conducted in the built environment and transportation sectors. But we're starting to see a growing use in several other sectors. We'll talk about housing specifically today, but we're also seeing growth in education, labor and employment policy, agriculture and food policy. So it's really being used in a diverse range of sectors. So since our focus is on housing today, I just wanted to provide a quick snapshot, of what housing HIAs look like in practice. And so these are just three examples of how HIA has been used in the housing sector. The first one at the top is around was used to inform a decision at the state level around funding for the low-income energy assistance program, the LIHEAP program at the state level. So it informed funding decisions and tried to help decision makers think about the potential relationships between energy policy and health and the potential cost implications of their funding decisions. There was at the local level, an HIA was used to inform decisions around a senior housing, affordable housing facility in California. And that facility was going to be sited very close to two very busy freeways. And so they made some recommendations for the design features of that building. One in particular that was implemented was to make a simple change to move the air intake vent from the side of the building that was directly adjacent to the freeway to the side that was not directly adjacent to the freeway, so that the air coming into that building for seniors who have significant respiratory health concerns would not be harmful to their health. And then finally, another state-level example that just wrapped up recently was conducted by the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, and they used an HIA to inform some decisions going on at the state level about how to streamline and potentially change the frequency of affordable housing inspections for state-funded affordable housing. So you can see there's a diverse range of applications. These are just a couple of examples of how HIA has been used in the housing realm. And we are going to focus today talking about HIA and health and housing in the context of the public housing program. So this is just one program to which you could apply HIA, but that will be our example today. So I'm going to provide just a quick snapshot on the public housing program. I will let Sunya and Ismail correct me if anything is inaccurate, because they are really the experts here and they will bring more to this. But just to give folks a snapshot about this. So HUD provides rental assistance to enable nearly 5 million low-income households adequate housing. And more than half of the households that are helped by HUD rental assistance are headed by seniors or people with disabilities. And there are two major federal housing programs, the Public Housing Program and the Housing Choice Voucher Program, that are administered locally by public housing authorities across the country. And those two programs serve about 70% of the HUD-assisted households. So they're the two of the major programs through which households are assisted. And so there are about 3,300 public housing authorities that are administering those programs. That includes about 1.2 million units of public housing, or about 22% of all of the HUD-assisted housing stock. And tenants pay no more than 30% of household income for their rent when living in public housing. So we're going to be focusing on the discussion today on seniors and people with disabilities. So just to give you a sense of how that population makes up the population of public housing, there are about 1.1 million households in public housing. And senior families, which HUD defines to be households where the head of household or the spouse is 62 or greater, represent about 31%. And then younger families that where either the head of household or the spouse is a person with a disability and who is less than 62 represent about 21% of those households in public housing. And so while to be eligible for public housing, households must be low income, but in practice, they're really almost 3 out of 4 households are extremely low income, which means that they are making less than 30% of the area family median income in their communities, which is roughly equivalent to the poverty level. So it's serving extremely low-income households. So the policy that Barry and I are going to talk about is called the Designated Housing Rule. This is a policy that has been in place since about 1994 from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it gives housing authorities the option to designate their public housing properties or a portion of their properties for senior families, for disabled families, or for a mixture of seniors and people with disabilities. And so in order to get approval to do this, housing authorities submit what are called designated housing plans to HUD. And those new plans are in place for 5 years, and then housing authorities can renew in 2-year increments. So this, in terms of the snapshot of public housing units as a whole, the designated housing rule is a pretty narrow or sort of small program in terms of its reach. So only about 4% of public housing authorities across the country have approved designated housing plans in place, which is about a total of 63,000 units of public housing. And now within those, about 91% of those are designated for senior households, and 4% are designated for people with disabilities, and then about 5% are designated for a mixed population of those two groups. One thing to note, though, is that the way that the policy was enacted, there are housing authorities that were essentially grandfathered into the way that they had been providing housing prior to the rule being in place. And so there are, we estimate there's about 137,000 additional units that are in buildings that are serving predominantly seniors or people with disabilities in public housing, but that are not under an active plan because of the way that the rule was enacted. So this is a sort of a snapshot of those that are officially approved, but we know that housing authorities in practice have a number of more units that are actually serving seniors and people with disabilities in predominantly buildings with those populations. So this just gives you a sense of the distribution of the use of the rule across the country. And so as you can see on the maps, the designated units are located predominantly on the East Coast and in the Midwest and in the metropolitan areas of those regions. And so not surprisingly, given that distribution, most of the housing authorities that are using the rule tend to be larger housing authorities that are located in big metropolitan centers. So the way that this work came about, so the Health Impact Project that I work for worked in partnership with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to do what was called a screening workshop. So one of the steps in HIA is screening to figure out whether HIA is a good application for that decision, whether it will add value to the discussion. And so as part of the National Prevention Council efforts that are headed by the Surgeon General, we did a workshop on health impact assessment with the Prevention Council and did a screening exercise with agencies to think about any decisions they might have coming down the pike that would be ripe to use HIA for, where they were interested in sort of testing the value of the tool in their decision-making process. And so as part of that, HUD stepped forward with the designated housing rule, and they said, you know, we know we're going to be updating this rule in 2015. We think that there are a lot of health implications for seniors and people with disabilities that may be served by public housing that is designated for these populations. And we're interested in seeing if we can think about our process from a different lens. And so we have collaborated with the Metropolitan Area Planning Council and the Oregon Public Health Institute to work collaboratively with HUD on this HIA and carry it out. And it was selected by HUD, I think, because of the timing was right, there's importance to health, and there was a lot of interest from stakeholders. This has been a somewhat controversial and divisive policy over time. There's been a lot of concern from advocates for both seniors and people with disabilities. There's a lot of implementation challenges, and so there was a growing interest to really have a new frame for dialogue around the policymaking. So you'll hear Barry talk a bit more about this, but we focused on six factors important to health that could be affected by the rule, and those include supportive services, housing discrimination and choice, housing affordability, the resident social environment within buildings, housing infrastructure and accessibility, and then the neighborhood characteristics surrounding those buildings. So those were the six factors that we looked at in the analysis. And I think just one last thing I'd like to point out before I let Barry sort of dive into the details is just that, you know, we were thinking about this as a pilot for the National Prevention Council agencies, you know, how they can take HIA and apply it to their decision making. And so one of the things that we've been very intentional about, although this has been a very comprehensive health impact assessment, we've intentionally selected methods and data sources that HUD could use in the future and sort of replicate and scale. So they may not have time to go through the full process that we did as part of this, but they may be able to build on some of the methodology, and especially I think the stakeholder engagement forum. So for example, we use national publicly available data sources, many of which HUD manages or, you know, is in the stewardship of, and so they would have access to those and would be able to use those sources. And then we use existing forums for stakeholder engagement and qualitative data collection. And so, you know, HUD requires housing authorities to have resident advisory boards to inform their policies. And so we use those connections in partnership with several case study sites to capture resident perspectives on designated housing. We also partnered with housing authority membership organizations as a way to get perspectives from housing authority executive directors and leaders and resident service coordinator staff. And so those folks are partners with HUD on a daily basis, and so these are mechanisms that HUD could use in the future if they wanted to do this for additional decisions. So I'll just leave you with a few HIA resources. These slides are going to be available online, so no need to furiously scribble them down. But if you're interested in learning more about HIA, there's a couple of places that you can go to learn more. And one thing I'll mention, if you're particularly interested in the intersection between housing and HIA, the Health Impact Project has been collaborating with the National Center for Healthy Housing on developing a housing HIA guidance document. So the purpose will be both to inform public health folks about how does housing get built, and you know, how is it funded, what are the key programs, and what are the opportunities in terms of decision points as it relates to HIA. And then for housing professionals, if they're interested in applying HIA to their work, how would they do that? What does an HIA look like? What do they need to do? Who would they partner with? And so that will be coming out in 2015, and so encourage folks to keep an eye out for that. And if you have particular interest in that resource, just let me know, and I'd be happy to make sure to get you on the distribution list for when that comes out. All right, so I just wanted to quickly thank all of the partners and funders for this work.